When I was little, we had a nuclear family, and it was great because I don't know, we never had discipline the way. But I mean, one of the things that struck me, I knew when I'd done wrong, and I think I felt much worse. Dad had a way of making me know that, I mean, what I had done was wrong. He never put a hand to me, but I felt, I mean, I've been spanked by teachers and stuff like that, and all it ever did with me was, like, you know, make me hate. And I'd have a way of taking my mind on what I'd done wrong and directing my, you know, I'd be hostile to the person that spanked me. But he had a way of making me feel like I was, you know, I mean, he knew how to make me know I'd done wrong. But we never had the violence in the family, none of the spanking, none of the, you know, the parents argued over different matters of just, you know, they disagreed over something. But it was, I don't know, it was just a good atmosphere, you know. And there was never favorites because they knew, I mean, I think it was, they had to, in their own minds, they had to prove that they didn't favor their natural born over their adopted children because they knew the children would have conflict over that. And, I don't know, it's just they always had time for us, and Dad always had time for us, and used to wrestle around with us and stuff, and show us love at the same time, and talk with us about what was right and wrong and everything. It was just, you know, anything you could imagine good about a family, that's what it was. And as I got older, Dad got more involved with people, because he knew he had something to offer. And we all knew he had something to offer to mankind. So people started coming in and seeing his goodness. And more and more he was pulled away from me, you know. And not just from me, but all of us. And he had less time for us. And he, you know, you could tell, you could see. I mean, it hurt. I think it hurt. I know it hurt him more than it hurt us. Because, which only combined... You know, it was sort of a combination with us, because not only did we feel hurt because we didn't have the time, but we also could see his hurt that he didn't have the time with us. And it made me hostile, very hostile, because the only thing I ever had to identify with was the nuclear family, was our family, because nobody ever tried to understand. You know, everybody hated for whatever reason. They just... You know, when you don't understand something, you usually strike out against it, you know, other than try to understand. And they just couldn't understand me having a black brother and an Asiatic brother and sister. And it was a conflict with me and anybody that I would try to make friends with. So the only thing I had was a family. And I saw, you know, I saw it falling apart. And it made me withdraw really bad. And I started to, you know, care about animals. That's when I started my thing with animals, because they were all I had, you know. And as long as I gave to them, they would give something to me. And then I kind of pulled away from people. So I guess that was a good aspect of, you know, it was a good part of my life, because animals have been, you know, fulfilling to me and stuff. But it was hard for me to come to realize that Dad had something to offer, and being a kid, I just could not, you know, I just never took into mind that it was selfish of me to think that I could have all of such a advanced mind and person, because he was far, you know. He's far ahead of most people intellectually, and he knows what's right, and he's been blessed with compassion. But at the same time, he's always had the ability to let you know when he stands on a subject, and I've never known anyone to not respect what he has to say. And
so what was it like when maybe you were a teenager or something? When he started maybe developing a communal lifestyle, so that the people were not just people who came to his church maybe once a week, but turn into a close-knit community. Maybe, I don't know if it was in Indianapolis or if it was in San Francisco. I mean, rather, by the Valley when it started. But how old were you when you started to have to really share your dad with, you know, a large community that was really close-knit, and it pulled on him, on his energy and his resources, to a much greater extent than any other dad that you knew?
Well, I'd say I was probably 8 or 9 when we started that had turned towards a more communal way of life, you know, not just the nuclear family, but anyone that believed what he believed and stuck with him was part of the family. Which now, you know, I see that's right, and I know that's right, and it's made my life a lot better, you know, having people that you can fall back on and know you can rely on. But at that time, I saw my dad just drained. I mean, what used to be a lively person and an energetic person just started to fade before my eyes. I mean, you could just see him just drained to the point of, you know, near death. I mean, I from that time on, it was nothing for me to think that, you know, Dad's only got at the most a couple years, you know. I mean, I'm to this day surprised that he's made it as long as he has, you know, because he always made a point to talk to me and, you know, let me know about my responsibilities if he isn't always with us. And it was the loving thing to do, because I don't know what I'd do if I'm ready for it now, but at that time I would have just gone completely insane if I'd lost him, because he'd been my only identification point, the only thing I had, you know, to keep me in touch with reality, because everybody seemed so cold and so distant and so selfish, and it made me really hostile. I'm, you know, like, I'm surprised that I just didn't totally turn away from what we believe and just become a totally selfish, you know, and self, you know, just totally self-centered person, you know, and because it made me hostile, because I had lost everything that seemed good to me. Of course, it was later replaced by something that's even better, you know. A better security, because there's no security. I mean, Dad made me feel secure, but what is one man or one family against a very hostile world? But it made me it turned me against that way of life, and it made me very withdrawn. It made people dislike me at the same time, because I was nasty, and I was I always thought I was right, and I never would shut my mouth, and I started fights over little things, and I turned, you know, I became what most people would call I can't think of the word for it, but I would have ended up in, you know, some sort of reform school if it hadn't have been for my dad, you know, keeping me, you know, I haven't parents that cared about me and I could go and talk to, because I had totally, I had become hostile to the world and people in general, because I felt they were taking something from me. But now I see I didn't, you know, they deserved it just as much as I did. But, we lived in Indianapolis up until the early 60s, because at that time, before we left Indianapolis, Dad was pastoring a church, and the way he could see it, he was kind of fighting a losing battle, because people were drawn from him but never making any kind of commitments to any ideals, and he knew that in Brazil, which is where we went, and other third world nations, that there were people starving that would be appreciative of what he had to offer. And at least he could do something for somebody instead of wasting his life on people that were and, you know, by no means ready to make any kind of commitment. So we left, I guess it must have been in 62 or something, for Brazil. And we said right off, you know, I don't remember much, but I know that Dad set right into setting up an orphanage for all the children that their parents had just died off. You know, the only thing I remember about is that I never had a shortage of playmates, and I thought it was great because I always had somebody to go out and play with, and they never, you know, looked down on me for having a black brother, because they were all, you know, they were all darker complected. But I just remember that we'd be eating because no matter how, you know, Dad never would live high. You know, we always would live in the poorer sections of town, and because he didn't want to lose that identification. Plus, he didn't feel right. He didn't feel right living higher and everything. But he always made sure that we were fed and that we had the little things that he feels children should have. But I remember that people would constantly be coming to the door wanting food and needing something because they were starving just right and left. I mean, we had lived what would be considered poor in the United States. But when we came down there, it just shocked me to see how people, you know, how people are forced to live in so many places. And it was hard for me to cope with for a long time because it was just, I don't know. It was. I just never even imagined that people could be so degraded and so malnourished and just so without anything. I mean, they had nothing. It was everything they could do to keep their families alive and themselves alive. And they. I mean, in a place like this, Dad always had something to do. He was always, you know, getting things done for the orphanage, or he was seeing about somebody, so he was away from the house quite a bit. And up till that point, I had always, strangely enough, I'd identified with my father more than I had with my mother, because he always presented both sides, you know, the strong figure, but at the same time the loving figure. So I didn't see how I needed anything else. But with him gone, I kind of had to turn to my mother, and I think from her I got a lot of my my compassion. I mean, I never felt like I had to prove anything to people, at least not at that time. I mean, I felt like I could say I love somebody. I knew I could cry and not feel like I was a sissy or weird. And so I kind of got a good balance of, I don't know, I just got a good balance. And I also had another woman that lived with us. It was, you know, she received a salary from us, but she really didn't do anything but you know, she lived with us, and she was kind of like a second mother. And it was a good experience for me because she was so down to earth, you know. She was so practical, because that's the only way she knew to survive is, you know, you had to be matter of fact. You couldn't get into a whole bunch of fairy tale and niceties, because it was a hard world. I remember we went one time to, because she'd go home every weekend and visit her family and see how they were, which also, you know, was shocking to me, because my parents always could find time, you know, to give us love and everything, but she had to make money or they would have died, so she didn't have any time to see him but on weekends. And I went home with her one time, and it was terrible. I mean, she lived on a mountain, on a little hill, and you just looked around, and the rains had washed half the houses down the hill. People were walking around trying to rebuild their little huts that were just made out of scrap. They'd go to the, I mean, it just looked like a junkyard. And it just had a hell of an impact on me, because I'd never, you know, realized that people could live like that. After being in Brazil for a couple of years, I don't know the exact time, it became evident to my dad and that there was going to be some sort of right-wing takeover, because there was too much unrest in the people, and they were getting tired of their living conditions and the way they were being oppressed. And Dad knew, was sure what would happen, so we got out of there. And sure enough, eventually there was a stronger government was put in power, and it was. But anyway, we got out, and we went back to Indiana. And no. And we, so anyway, we went back to Indiana for a short while. It was only the most, I think, a year and a half. And it was about that time that I started school. I went to kindergarten. And before that time, I had never really ventured out into the world much. And I'd stayed, you know, the only thing I knew about the world was my family. And it was hard for me, because, you know, ever since I can remember, I had a black brother, and I had a Korean brother and sister, and until I was well along in life, I wasn't even told that they weren't my natural brother and sister. I thought they had come from the same place I had, you know, because we'd always been taught that nobody was any different. And I just couldn't understand. I mean, it just seemed irrational to me. I mean, it just didn't even, there was no way I could understand that I was acceptable to these people, but my brothers and sisters weren't. And from the start, I was incorrigible. But I guess after a while, I learned to cope with it, and then I did better in school. But I was only in school for like a half a year. I was in kindergarten in Indiana, and then we moved out to Redwood Valley, because the people were starting to call us up on the phone and shoot at us and just mess with our car and just anything, you know. They were starting to harass us, is all they were starting to do. And Dad, once again, we had to run. We had to get out of there, because he wanted to protect his family. And not just meaning us. There were other people that were loyal to him and he cared about. And we all made the move. But my mother and Jimmy and I were the first to go, because we came out and we kind of got the house and cleaned up and all that before everybody else came. But so I started first grade in Redwood Valley, and if anything, it was worse. I mean, there was nobody. We lived in Indianapolis. We lived in the poor area, and we lived in the black area. So I went to school with a lot of, you know, there were at least some black children in school, but there was nobody here. I mean, it was unbelievable. And they acted like they'd never seen a black person before. They acted like they were inhuman, you know. You'd hear the chants every day, and eventually you just kind of got immune to it. But at least one thing that was different about Redwood Valley, I wasn't acceptable either. I mean, we were all unacceptable. My brothers and sisters were unacceptable because they were colored, and I was unacceptable because I accepted them. So at least I could understand that. I mean, I could understand that people people would be people. But at least I felt like I once again had an identification with my family. And I didn't have to worry about them resenting me. Pretty much all of my early years, I knew that we were different, that people saw us as different, and that we weren't, you know, that, well, just that we were different, but I always thought that it would just stay there. I mean, I would have my family, we would feel how we feel, and everybody else would feel how they feel, and that I could, it would stay that way, one day, just kind of all came crashing down on me, when that wasn't true, because I was about 12 years old. I was out in the parking lot, and dad got shot, and I just remember the loud noises, and and all the people around, there were hundreds of people around, and he was out seeing the people, and it just hit me hard, because at that time, he was doing what he'd done all his life, reaching out to people, showing them love, giving them something they'd never had before, and he all I saw was, I heard the noises, and he was slammed hard on his face, it was traumatic for me, but and then at that time, I came to realize how far people would go to wipe out anything they didn't understand, or, you know, even worse than that, that they could hinder their exploits. And
how did it happen? Describe that. First of all, where it happened. How?
I remember we were in Redwood Valley at the temple we had there, and it was a big weekend meeting, and they had the band outside and everything. Everybody was eating outside in the parking lot. It was kind of like a big picnic, and you know, Dad had come out like he always did to give everyone as the best of his ability, everyone attention and love, and I was over with a bunch of the guys. We just played some basketball, and we were talking, you know, and joking around, and they were teasing me about this girl I liked or something, and the band had been playing loud and everything, and they had stopped, and then I just heard three really loud noises, and I looked in that direction. I thought it was a drum or something. And I saw Dad, you know, slam down on his stomach. And all I remember is I just started screaming, you know, a high-pitched, loud scream. I didn't know what else to do. It was kind of like everything just happened. I mean, it just came crashing down on me. I didn't know what had happened. I didn't know, you know, I had no familiarity with any kind of guns or anything. I didn't know what it was. And because I remember he had reached out and touched some woman's hand, and it was like, right when he did it, he fell down. Really, I mean, it wasn't just falling down, though. It was like something just, a big weight had just come down on his back and slammed him down. But I remember that, you know, I know if anybody would have thought, I mean, I know from the way he was hit that the person had to come. We had a grape vineyard on the around our house, all around the property. And you just, because from the way he was shot and the way he was standing, you know that's where it came from. And I know he knew. I know he did, because he was facing right. He was hit in the stomach. But I remember now. I thought my dog. I had a big dog. His name was Husky. I thought he was scared because he went charging out into this vineyard. You know, I thought he was scared of the gun or the shots. And because Dad pointed and says, "No, it's over there. It's over this way." Because, you know, I know now that he knew that he would, people would have torn him apart, because I remember this old guy, Richmond Stahl, who I've always liked, you know, I mean, he's a drunk, and, you know, everybody calls him a good for nothing, and I mean, like he was, you know, just that, he was good for nothing, but I've always identified with him because, I don't know, I knew a lot of religious people, a lot of people that, so you know, thought they had their morals together, but they were so phony. I mean, it was just, I'd always remembered the phoniness. I never got anything out of them but phoniness. I mean, it just kind of, they had an aura about them. I mean, you just picked it up every time you got around them. You knew somebody that was, well, but I just remember Richmond. He looked around, and all he saw was a pick, and he was sick. He was having trouble with his heart, and he picked that pick up. And I just know that if he would have got a hold of that person, that they would have, they wouldn't have survived it. And Dad knew this, and so he steered him wrong. But to this day, I don't know who did it. I don't know what it was done with. I guess it was a pistol, a handgun, but I never saw the person. But it kind of made me realize that from then on it'd be one hell of a fight. I mean, it would be more than just a disagreement. Would it be a conflict? They would be constantly trying to snuff us out because they just couldn't. Some people, I mean, there are different reasons. Some people, they just knew that the way of life Dad was trying to bring about would go against their different way, you know, their exploitation and the way they wanted to make money. You know, everybody wanted to do their own thing. They didn't care about who they hurt. And there were other people that knew their selfish way of life, and they knew it was wrong. And every time they saw us, they were reminded that it was wrong. And for that reason, they wanted to get rid of us. And then there were just people that didn't understand us. And for the most part, when people don't understand something, they strike out against it. But I think that was the time that I realized that it wasn't going to be easy. Like I said, from that point on, it was like, you know, a fight, just a fight. I mean, we just thought we were just holding out just for a few days longer. We always felt that way. We never kind of expected to last much longer. I mean, either we would be totally snuffed out, or we would change the way we felt. I mean, that was the only way of doing it. And I guess, I mean, I know that we finally realized that there was people who had been given just enough to make them satisfied, because for the most part, human beings and animals in general are—they're self. I mean, they're worth. If they're doing okay, that's fine. That's all they need. They, you know. And there was nobody willing to change anything. So it was kind of like, you know, a waste of time. And you know, Dad knew that he had a couple thousand people that acted like they wanted something. They wanted to change, or they knew their way of life was wrong, and they knew that, you know, they just weren't happy. So I guess he just thought, at least if he was going to, you know, if he couldn't, it'd be better to do something for these few people than nothing at all for anybody. And we moved down here, and I came down early, you know, and all that was down here is the people that came originally and a few other guys that had so much trouble in the States that they were just on their way to prison. And Dad knew it, and we all knew it, and it was the parents' decision to send them here, because we all expected to come anyway, eventually. And just from the time that they left until I got down there, which is like a few months, the change in them, it was phenomenal. I mean, they felt. I mean, I don't know. I just like let's say Ronnie. You know, I mean, he didn't care about anybody. He was constantly starting some. I mean, I just thought. I mean, he was what I considered a punk in the States. I mean, I just had no time for guys like him. And now I come down here, you know, he works, and like, he's always, I don't know, he brightens up my day, because sometimes, you know, I might feel down or something, and he's just, I mean, he's funny, you know, and he cares. You know, he points out little things that I've even stopped noticing because I felt like it didn't do any good because you just sat there and you noticed it. And there was times that I would mention it to people and they just look at me like, you know, you're weird. You know, who cares about it? You know, who cares? It's not happening to you. So, you know, and it feels good to me to know that there's somebody else that, I mean, he's pointing it out to me. And that's been good for me. And it's also, I've seen that change in everybody because at least now, Dad, I mean, he's worked to the point that he's you know, ready to fall any minute, but at least he's been able to work with these people and get something into their heads, you know, get feeling into their heads. And it just, you get the feeling that people care, at least, you know, somebody cares, and that they're trying to at least. I don't know. Here, I don't know. I guess I see my role as I don't know. I kind of think of myself as an identification point for guys my age and people in general, because Dad no longer can. I mean, he does it to the best of his ability, but he no longer can be that like he used to be. You know. That's why I don't carry. I mean, they want me to get into the more of the administrative part, you know, and I've gotten into, you know, like the steering committee and stuff, but I still feel like I've got to stay down, you know, not that physical labor is the only work there is. I know that's not true, but just around guys. I mean, I feel like the way to give leadership, and the only way I got it from Dad was just as a person, you know, as on a personal basis. It wasn't from just him preaching to me. It was, you know, I got it from him. And I think that's the best way to get it across to a lot of these guys, is not to just throw it at them and to say you're wrong for feeling that way or preaching at them what's right. I mean, they'll rebel against that. I just feel like you have to take it gradually, you know, and point out little things. Like with Ronnie, I know, you know, sometimes he'll make jokes about things that just shouldn't be, and I'll say, you know, put yourself or somebody you care about in that place and try to feel that way, you know, about what, you know, how bad it would be. And also, I guess I see myself as a person, you know, building this place, you know. But for the most part, I just also, I'm trying to, because I used to fight all the time and stuff. It was just, mostly it was trying to prove something. Also, it was I had a lot of hostility, but I'm trying to show and I think I'm making progress by, you know, not fighting. I don't even think about fighting anymore, and trying to be more loving with people, and I'm trying to break down the competitiveness between, you know, young guys. I mean, that's all I can talk about. I don't know about, but guys, you know, competing over who's the strongest, you know, who can do the most work and everything. I'm gradually trying to break that down. But I don't know. I kind of see myself as the identification point. I mean, the person that, you know, carries it. I don't know.
You need to hold it. Your voice is loud enough.
That would be better because it makes me feel like I'm reciting. But like I was saying, what I mean by identification point would be, I don't know, something that people could relate to, because I don't know. Because like I look at somebody, I mean, people I know work hard, you know, and I've just seen them break their backs. I mean, but people don't see him enough, and people have no way of knowing, you know, and they don't want to know. I mean, for the most part, people just don't, out of nowhere, just come up with feeling. I mean, you have to put it right in front of their face, you know, they have to know. And because I know, like, Dad doesn't have the time, right, to give everybody what he gave me, the personal because I know you, it has to be personal. You have to touch, you have to be able to feel, you know, before you can relate to it. You know, the people, you're not going to, somebody can come up and tell you that, like even with, like you were saying about Victor Hart, I mean, they can tell you what he went through, but you just don't identify as much. Like, you identify more with, like you said, Johnny Spain, because you knew him, you know what I mean? And, so, I feel like it's my role to, in some way, show them, you know, that, I mean, be like they were. I mean, like, be like they were and like what they saw important, and get to know them in that way, and gradually break it down and you know, lessen this image, you know, the big tough guy image, and take it slow, because, you know, by feeding little things and, you know, a pat here, a pat there, or they point out, oh, wow, you know, that was good, you say, you know, that ain't nothing, you know, that's, you know, that's not important, and just do it slow, because if you just walk up to a guy and start hugging him and kissing him, I mean, he's just going to, you know, he's going to say, oh, this guy is weird, and, so, I mean, that's the way I see it, is to take it slow, because you don't just totally change people's way of thinking, you know, I mean, you just don't do it overnight, you just, it has to be taken slow, so, that's the way I look at it, you know. For the most part, the people we went to school with were a lot of liberal, you know, crap heads. I mean, you know.
At Drew.
Yeah.
What kind of school was Drew?
It was a private. It was progressive. I mean, but they were all a whole bunch of. Every teacher thought that they had the answer to the world. You know what I mean? You just. They were good teachers. I mean, like, we had all college books, and they made it so you could understand. But they're evil maniacs. I mean, they really thought they were saying, but
that's what ultimately turned you off, or was?
Not, no. Also, you could just see when you I mean, I felt guilty about going to this school, because, you know, it was uppity. I mean, people would
Rich
get dropped off at school, huh?
Rich people.
Yes. People got dropped off in limousines, chauffeur-driven limousines. Guys in school would drive up in their Camaros, and their, one girl had a Mercedes. I don't know if it was her parents' car. And you just couldn't relate. You couldn't relate to these people. You couldn't relate at all. I mean, we used to knock them on their ass a couple times, you know, throwing stuff at them that they just were not ready for. I mean, they agreed with it. Most of them agreed with the way we believed, I mean, but they weren't ready for it. But, oh, I don't know. And then we'd come home, and you'd be talking to kids in the temple that weren't going to this school, you know, and You felt, I mean, you just felt bad about it. Really, I really felt bad about it. And, I never, for the most part, that was it. And we knew the fantastic amount of money they were paying for the school, and, I just didn't feel it was worth it, because I felt the only education I really was getting was from Dad, you know. And reading and writing would come, I mean, I know we were learning more than reading and writing. I'd already learned how to read and write, but that education was secondary, because I didn't think it would do any good.
So, just to give a little background, how many students from the temple went to church, and for how long?
I'd say, I'd say 15. I'm not, it can't be exact, 15 to 20 at the most.
How long did they go there?
Probably 3 months.
And then the students decided to draw from the school?
Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Because of the expense that it was costing the organization, and also because you felt bad about receiving such a high quality education while other teenagers in the temple were going to public schools?
drive. Because, like, one thing that would make me realize is that some of these, there were kids there that had gotten just kicked out of other schools because they were so incorrigible, right? And their parents were well off enough to send them to this place, but they were still, like, they were black kids, so they still rebelled. Right? So they came to this school because none of the public schools would have them. And to be in class and have them called on and just sit there and, you know, you've just been called on before and you knew the answer, you know, and you'd run off the big thing because the big intellectual spiel or whatever. And this kid would just, he'd drag you right back down to what it was really like, you know, that there really was no education for the common folk. And I don't know, it just kind of got to me. It's kind of a conflict that I just couldn't, you know, it just seemed a contradiction, all that we believed in to be going to this school. You know what I mean? And not all of us, you know, thought about it the way I did. I mean, some people just plain old wanted to go to public school and
just to hang out. Some people wanted to go to public school just to hang out.
Yeah. And I don't know, I think what brought it about is I was playing basketball in this gym, and this guy came and asked me what school I went to, and he was from Washington High, and he wanted me to come play with him, play for him and everything, and then we got to talking about it and how we didn't like the place anyway, and I said, you know, it cost too much money anyway, and the guy could get, it was, I don't know, he knew he could get me into school, so I figured, you know, that's how it came about. I don't remember exactly how, but then we got to talking about it and how we all really hated it, because I was already cutting from the, because it's just, you know, it just seems stupid.
Okay. In September, kind of everything was starting to point, you know, things that were happening in the government and things that were being said about us and just the whole trend in general was pointing towards a right-wing takeover, or, you know, just, we didn't see it. We were becoming, it looked like to us that our position here wasn't secure any longer, and like we were expecting any time to see an army coming up at us, you know. And at that time, we were having a lot of harassment from, I don't know who. We saw people come, and they'd come in, you know, with weapons and stuff and take shots at us and just totally harassed us and had us on edge 24 hours a day.
Previous to, you know, the actual days, what we call on the line here, there had been a direct and unequivocal assassination attempt on Jim Jones, because he was in his house and there were shots fired from a high-powered rifle that came within inches of his head, right? So it was clear to us that there was a move to destroy us. And then there was a sudden, you know, quick, something happened in the government that we thought that on that day, there would be troops out to take over Jonestown.
And, like, it was kind of like, you know, the first time I saw Dad shot, it kind of, because I had subconsciously, I guess, kind of come to think of this as a, you know, a world of its own. I mean, I thought that we could go on, you know, without any harassment from the outside, without any trouble. We could build, you know, just the whole idealistic trip. And it kind of, once again, it made me realize that at the struggle wherever you're at, because there's too many people that are living off, you know, that are living good off other people's oppression, and they do not want to see communism, and they know Dad, and they know, you know, his leadership, and they know his potential, and they know what he can do with people, and I think they kind of see this as a kind of breeding ground for commies, you know, and they want to snuff it out. All I remember is, like, you know, the first thing that happened, I mean, we didn't even expect it, was, you know, when Dad was shot at that night. And,
that was in, like, the end of August or the very beginning of September, right?
Right.
77.
It was in 77. And, like, we had just been down there talking to Dad. And me and Johnny were walking up here. And we heard it, and we came running back there, and then, you know, my heart sunk, you know, because I realized that it's just going to start up again. I just knew it, but,
So it brought back the whole extremely painful thing for you of thinking that your dad had just been killed, right? Just, like, because you didn't know at the time whether he had or hadn't been when you were walking away from the house. The same that you saw him hit the cement, maybe about 2 years earlier.
It just, you know, it was almost, I mean, it was the same.